Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yep, sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. And this week, what are we discussing, Kevin?
The Eyes of the Overworld.
Cool.
By Jack Vance, 1966.
Who narrated it?
Arthur Mori.
All right. Could you give us a reading from the back of the book? Now, this is the back of the book on the Audible version that actually gives the entire plot away, which is...
Including the ending.
Including the ending.
This is... I lifted this from one of the earlier printings.
Okay.
So it is a real back of the book, just...
As opposed to a fake one?
Yes. I didn't just make up my own interpretation. Into blinding madness or visions of splendor, such was the power of the priceless magic eyes of the overworld, that it could exalt their wearer to realms of wonder or plunge him into dark terror. Now Yukinu, the laughing magician, has dispatched an unwilling thief, Kugel the Clever, on a fantastic quest to capture the enchanted violet lenses. Across forests of unending marvels he journeys to a world where sorcery and science are one.
Thundar the Barbarian.
Yes, Thundar does sound like it was basically straight out of Jack Vance after you read it.
Yeah.
So if the lenses are so important, why didn't the laughing magician just go after them himself?
I think he kind of wanted them, but didn't want to bother that much.
He was laughing.
Too much nitrous oxide?
Or too little. All right, so what did everybody think? Or I can give my... multi-point discussion yes. here.
I will say I actually like this book, and I like the setting as well. There's like four books, and the books are actually basically concatenations of multiple short stories that he had previously written.
Yeah, this is what they call a fix-up, which is a term that I hadn't really known before reading about this book.
But yeah.
Just about anything you open up is just like, this is a fix-up. And then you were just like, what the hell is a fix-up?
Right. It's like I fixed up all these short stories, kind of, you know, wrote some interstitial stuff, and right. Now it's a book.
I fixed up a lack of novel in my current output.
Right. It says that they were stories that appeared in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction between December 65 and August 1966. So this was like something like 15 years after his first book in the series, you know, 65. And then he wrote the third and fourth book like in the mid 80s. So they said, you know, you should be really thankful if you're a fan of
the Kugelverse.
No, God damn it. You know, that guy that writes that stuff that's really popular. Brain totally, you know, the guy you almost hit with your car in the taxi.
R.R. Martin.
Yes.
As opposed to like, say, Elmo.
Yes.
George R.R. Martin.
They basically said, you know, people, fans of George R.R. Martin, stop complaining because, you know, there's
Steve
less than
almost
like,
had him run over with a taxi.
Less than 20 years in between, between his books. So,
I think you'll be able to get that story if you listen to last year's Hugo episode, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yes.
You'll just have to use your imagination about me nearly killing George R.R. Martin.
Well, you by proxy.
Yes.
Yes, you were in the taxi, so your fault. I will say that on this listen, there were some bits that I think my brain had sort of filtered out about how bad Kugel kind of actually is in certain circumstances, but... I still find him amusing just in context, you know. Mm-hmm. It's
I have to say, from the Magic Man from Adventure Time, I finally figured out who he was based on.
That's pretty much, yeah.
I guess that does make sense. I didn't think about that.
I mean, okay, so my take on it is I see where the book is going, and I see that it got there. I just was not along for the ride. Because, yeah, this is an amoral world, and this is definitely an amoral guy. And I get the impression you're supposed to be kind of along with on his side, but you know, you can sort of root along as he fails as well as succeeds.
Right.
But he was just too nasty for me to enter his shoes, shall we say.
Right.
Some people refer to this as a picaresque novel, which is a term that I actually learned just now. But apparently that's a story about a lovable rogue that isn't bound by the conventions of society, and he just goes around and does whatever he wants. But I get the impression that that's supposed to be like your fantasy of what you could do if you weren't sort of hemmed in by all these rules. And this guy's a psychopath. He does a lot of violence and like coercion against women. I'll get into stronger language later on. The other problem is that, you know, the language is very heightened and some people love that and some people hate that. And when I like the book overall, I love that in the book. And if when I have problems with the book, I find it really annoying because now I have to piece through it to figure out the horrible thing that's happening underneath it. Also, the narrator was really good, but he had this sort of solemnity to him. And every once in a while, he'd have to say something like, well, what about the erotic instrument? Or, stand back. I have a tube which can project a blue gel.
Blue concentrate.
Concentrate, sorry. I was always assuming that he had a toothpaste tube.
Yeah, later on I was thinking, was that like a can of spray paint or something?
I never really did figure out what that was supposed to be.
I thought it was a can of spray paint until the powerful magician also was sort of seen to be concerned about it. So either he was just didn't want to get sprayed in the face with blue spray paint, or it really was dangerous. I'm not sure.
Maybe they were all like plaque on teeth. Maybe he just had toothpaste the entire time. Maybe I should rethink this entire thing. Maybe
it's really just, you know, copper sulfate that you spray on wood to be, you know, treat it before it goes into the ground so that, you know, no living thing can survive contact with it.
Exactly. So all of my objections are pretty much countered by somebody saying, but that was what he was going for. And it's just like, yeah, that I see that.
Well, yeah, I can say that this was probably the first book, at least definitely the first one that I remember, where there was a true anti-hero, not like an anti-hero like James Bond, who was like, you know, sure, he does bad stuff, but it's for a good cause, kind of. And it's like, no, he just is out for himself.
Sure.
And, you know, he's not 100% reprehensible. He does every once in a while help somebody, you know, that
puts mostly by accident.
Yeah, there was only one time that I remember where, you know, the guy said, run away, save yourself. And he's like, normally that's exactly what I would do. But, you know, he kind of helped him anyway. And, you know, but that was very rare.
Okay.
And a big component of this still is kind of the setting and not just the, I mean, obviously it was about Kugel and he was sort of the thrust of the stories, but I think the setting itself is a large contribution, you know, even if you wipe all of Kugel's exploits out, you know, you can.
Sure. And I like the idea of the dying Earth where they know that it's dying and pretty much know that like any sunset could be their last, but everybody seems to be sort of behaving somewhat normally. I guess that could explain why they're being so self-centered all the time. They're not really planning for the future very much.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a little post-nuke almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, or just pre-nuke.
We're getting there. It's about to go off. Yeah, I like the setting of the book. And, you know, like you guys, I kind of had a hard time feeling any sort of positive things about Kugel. I mean, other than the fact that he was moving the story forward. Yeah. I don't know. It's just, you know.
I mean, were you enraged more at his lack of morals or the fact that he wasn't very good at it?
Well, his lack of time crimes really...
You know. So that he didn't really have a time machine. Okay. Yeah.
Well, not one that was under his control and, you know, could actually monetize it. So
they did have an interesting little theoretical discussion of, you know, where he visits the same location, you know, across time. And then he's like, huh, it's weird that, you know, this should really be the first one because it's earlier in time, but I'd already seen it in the future. So which one is actually the first time?
Yeah, I think I missed that.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Anyway, so the other kind of, you know, primary reason that I even read this to begin with is it's another Appendix N book.
Right, which we will get into in discussion points, so you don't need to go into it right now.
But you have to mention it as a pre-spoiler thing so that people know.
Oh, right, so that all of your Appendix N fans hey, can hang on through the break.
Hashtag Appendix N. Anyway, yes, we can go into detail later, but this is explicitly called out in the Appendix N list as opposed to just the author.
All right. Well, it's pitch dark right now, so I'm worried we might be eaten by a grue. So I think it's time for us to take a bit of a break and come back for our discussion section. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion of The Eyes of the Overworld by Jack Vance. Again, narrated by Arthur Morey, because that's under that previous part on this piece of paper in front of me.
Good job.
Yes. And this was in 1966. I don't know if we mentioned that before. All right. So, yes, Kevin, you are going to enthrall us with your discussion of how this is an Appendix N book.
Oh. What's Appendix N?
Well, don't you know, Barry? Yes.
It's a leading question.
Okay.
Also known as a trap.
Yes, Appendix N, the list that Gary Gygax made of the supposed books that were influences when they created D&D, you know, Arneson and Gygax.
But for legal reasons, you know, Tolkien is not.
Tolkien is listed there.
Okay.
Just there. Well, we'll leave that.
They had to play some anagram games with some of those.
Well, even anyway. With this, there was, you know, one of the monsters in here. They reuse in D&D, but they renamed Diodand to Demodand, apparently.
Okay.
Because it's close enough. So, yes, as far as one of the biggest contributions to Dungeons & Dragons that basically the author made, you know, via Gary Gygax, is what, you know, is termed Vancian magic, where basically spells, instead of having spell points or some other kind of way to measure your power, you memorize specific spells, and once you use it, it's basically out of your memory, and you have to re-memorize it for the next time that you want to use it. And it's kind of an unusual system, I guess, and I'm kind of used to it now, but
I find it completely normal.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, that's kind of, you know, what I grew up with, but when you think about other magic systems, it's kind of rare that...
You mean less successful magic systems?
Yes. that, you know...
Other, and therefore lesser magic systems.
And I won't go into too much excruciating detail about this, but, you know, I did leave out several passages that I could have read from the book describing about him, you know, trying to force, you know, the words of the spell into his brain. But anyway, it's exciting.
Okay, great.
Other random bits from this book, you know, that I didn't even think about until I was researching this again, that apparently Vecna is an anagram of Vance, and that was apparently...
Wow, I feel... I mean, feel like I've been out-nerded for a moment here.
Yes, it never occurred to me that was the source of Vecna, but apparently that's a semi-official thing. It wasn't just it happens to be a, you know...
Right. It's not just a coincidence.
It's not just a coincidence that's actually how they got the name.
And yeah, I was startled when he mentioned Gruz in here, because, of course, I grew up playing Zork, and I think it was first in Zork where they had, "It is pitch black, you may be eaten by a Gru."
Right, and yeah, Grus were from this book.
And they had some definition of a Gru is this thing mixed with this and an unusual hoon.
Right, and it was kind of interesting because this whole series does have kind of the whole concept of, I mean, it's essentially like, you know, DNA stuff but they don't ever call it that. It's like, you know, Vance, you know, had basically said, well, it's like these wizards had vats and they would create creatures in their vats. And in this case, the king wanted a menagerie of crazy things. So like you said, it's like, you know, Gru is this mixed with the this and that, you know.
Well, and I particularly remember like an unusual hoon or like something like that. And a hoon is an Australian term for a really bad driver. So I'm just imagining him getting this Australian guy who can't drive.
It's like that guy from the last book that from Mount Char, the taxi guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
he wasn't Australian.
Just threw him into the vat.
At the very least, there's a lot of kind of D&D-like flavor that I think was added from Vance with kind of like the artifacts and the really weird, unique magic items that seem to serve no real purpose.
Like the magic vibrator?
I don't remember that specifically, but...
I mean, if I actually thought of this as a Let's Play novel or whatever the term that we were using before, where this was just somebody's D&D campaign...
It is in reverse, basically.
Because this guy is a murder hobo, you know? He is just going around just like, oh, well, that's mine now.
Right.
Oh, and now I have the power of it, and I should be treated with respect.
You say I'm in trouble? Well, why don't you feed me then?
And I will say the one thing that I really love about the setting is the spell names. And that's something that D&D didn't really keep except in, you know, a couple Mordenkainens, this and that, you know, and basically I find the spell names very evocative, but they're so like Victorian in their wording that at first you're like, what the hell is he talking about? But it kind of like can evoke, you know, sort of beyond what it really should. Like the charm of forlorn insistment, as insist, not like I insist that you do this, because that's what I thought it was at first.
Oh, okay. No, it's in assist.
Yeah. Thrasdubal's Lagonetic Transfer, which is basically teleport, you know, but, you know, instead of just magically appearing, a demon picks you up and flies you there. You know, Lugweiler's Dismal Itch. And, you know, there were a few others, but
I should say that after Planet of Adventure, I was a little disappointed that not all of the names were food this time.
Yeah. Yes.
I felt myself pining for some, you know, nacho ceviche.
Yeah, exactly. No, Kugel, of course, is I believe it's a savory sweet pastry favored by Eastern Europeans somewhere, but I don't have that written down, so I'm going by memory. So I may have just offended an entire continent.
Yeah, much like Kugel?
Much like Kugel, yeah.
He's Kugel, like, I don't understand your cultural norms. Feed me. Give me stuff.
Give me stuff. Send me women now.
Yes. Make me your guard on the border and give me a wife.
That was, yeah, pretty disturbing.
Hey, they offered it to him, so it was okay, right?
So, yeah, I mean, that kind of leads us into, was Kugel a likable rogue, you know, or did it go too far? What did you guys think before I...
Too far.
he really did go too far. Someone was trying to argue online that he was like tit for tat. If someone was trying to screw him over, he would screw them back, but like times 10.
Well, with men, usually, there was some sort of provocation.
Right.
With women, he usually believed there was a provocation, but if you sort of tried to get any sort of objective reading of the situation, then no.
Right. That was definitely over the top, and... I guess you can argue what it would have been thought of in the 60s when you wrote it, but it was still kind of like, you know, there are definitely some James Bond issues, you know, where it's sort of like, hey, baby, let's, you know, and then it's like, you know, they're like,
I know you're bad. Let's get together.
Yeah. You know, there's definitely kind of this assumption that, you know, seems to underline things that.
Well, there was one scene that was sort of, okay, that's it for me, which was, well, there were two of them. First was a little bit more obviously played for comedy, which was he's in a tight spot and he basically gets out of it by selling his female companion into slavery.
Right. And that, you know, yes, that wasn't a good thing. But yeah, it was definitely done in an air of, you know, dark comedy, right? Where he's afterwards, he's sort of convincing himself about, you know, she's like, you've been duped, you know, basically.
Yeah, you're not clever.
He tricked you into this thing. You know, he supposedly walked you through this dangerous forest, but really he just led you around in circles for an hour and then said that he, you know, saved you from all these magical traps or something. And you're just being stupid. And later on, he's kind of telling himself, well, that guy was stupid. You know, that's not the case. She doesn't know what she's... And I was... What else could I have done? I was doing it for her own good. It was... Where I'm going is really dangerous, so I'm really helping her. He's like, well, what else could anybody possibly have done in my situation? He's like, I'm a great guy, you know? Yeah. So that was obviously sort of him kind of half realizing he got screwed because he almost went to walk back and either help her or at least say get mad about it until Firk sort of like twisted his liver. Right. And so he's kind of like, okay, never mind.
He has a... creature inside him that is sort of his, well, conscience is definitely not the right term.
Yes.
And who knew that 60 years later that Kugel would be reincarnated as the president of the United States?
yeah, that was sort of my thought. It's just like, yeah, this guy could be president, and that's the worst thing I could say. Yeah, no, it was the second incident where he has been cheated. Basically,
I believe it's more like karmic retribution.
Yeah.
Yeah. They basically show up, you know, he shows up at this thing where there's a watchtower and like, we have to watch for Magnats, who's going to come hurt us. Like, what's Magnats? Well, it's just one of our customs. We don't know, but you know, we have to have someone doing it. We have these crazy, you know, things we do here. Mm-hmm. And so they say, hey, you basically, you know, become a baron of the land. You can have whatever wife you want. You can have, you know, it's this huge pile of riches, you know, crazy, awesome food. And all you have to do is sit and like watch for Magnus to show up. And he's like, well, that sounds like a reasonable thing because I'm kind of like half starving now anyway. And
that sounds totally reasonable. I mean, obviously, no, it's too good a deal to be true.
Obviously, it's just, this sounds like a really important job. You know, you think you wouldn't foist it upon some.
Right. And, you know, he's like, well, my own, the son of the leader of the village is doing it now, you know, as an interstitial, you know, functionary in between the last one and our new one. But we've decided to give it to you. So obviously the reader knows he's getting screwed, but he doesn't.
And the last one tried to run away, but we basically strung him up and killed him.
We don't know why he would do that.
Right. So he's up there for... They say he studied everyone's going on in the village, so he must have been up there for at least a few weeks, right?
Right. But, I mean, like, immediately he just, like, sees the prettiest girl in the village, just like, she shall be my wife.
Right.
Yeah. Now.
And also the other things that are on his list are like, I want a new rug and food and...
And they're like, oh, okay, we'll get it. We'll go get it right now.
Yeah. And he's basically like stuck in a cage.
Right. So he's basically, yeah, he's in the Space Needle or something. Right. You know,
and they're just like
with a pair of binoculars.
Exactly.
Right. And they give him very basic food and,
right.
You know,
they lift him up there in some sort of like elevator thing and then they remove the rope.
Right. And it turns out that all that it really takes is somebody watching for magnats. There's a compact between magnats in the village that magnats will never attack so long as someone is watching.
Right. Some previous magician had like done some kind of spell to say, as long as you're, you know, not going to stop looking for him to come back, this will keep him asleep or away or something. And the thing is, they don't even tell Kugel that. They just sort of like dupe him into it. And then they wait for, you know, they say, we're going to give you great food, all that stuff. And then they give him like, you know, crappy leftovers and like, you know, an old sleeping bag basically.
Right.
So in this case, I agree that he has reason to be pissed off.
Sure.
He still, you know, goes past what you would consider to be moral behavior.
Well, let's see. So yeah, the, you know, he picks out a girl and says, all right, I'll marry her. And it seems very clear to anybody watching that she is not taking this seriously. She's obviously like,
oh, okay, you know,
obviously paying attention to this other guy, but she's like, yeah, okay, uh-huh. And, you know, he doesn't have the ability to sort of understand that this is not happening no matter what she says.
Right.
But okay, you know, still, he's being led on, whatever. But this is, of course, what every whatever asshole guy is saying these days. She led me on.
Right.
He leaves the cage. He stops watching. He figures out a way down from this thing. Basically goes, grabs her, and they're together in a boat. And he's just like, well, you will perform your wifely duties to me, or I will.
He's going to like basically call magnets to destroy the village.
Right. So basically he's raping her, you know, with threats.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it just says, and so she did. And I'm just like, okay, you just crossed the line. And it's just there and line gone.
Right. Yes, I agree. That is definitely crossing the line.
And I think it kind of makes it worse that I think that that's in there because it was barely acceptable at the time.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was saying is I almost feel like when it was written that that would be, well, he talked her into it. That's different. And you're like, not really.
Maybe in the 60s,
it was considered talking her into it. I don't know.
I mean, I'm going to kill your family unless you sleep with me.
Right.
He's like, I talked her into it. Have sex.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the most bizarre thing is they, you know, not related to that part, but that, you know, related to the whole, his whole situation there that they didn't even bother to tell him that this pact existed even after the fact that he was stuck up there. Like, if you stop watching, you know, the village will be destroyed. Of course, maybe that would encourage them to stop watching at that point. But
yeah, I mean, I think that you could definitely make the argument that the villagers didn't perform optimally either.
Right. I mean, I would say
that doesn't excuse it.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, his act with her wrong, you know, yeah. You know, in a fictional context,
old moral stance.
Yes,
there.
I know. In a fictional context, I almost think the villagers deserve retribution, you know, for, you know, you know, putting them up there, you know, but
it's, sure. If the whole thing had just been, so he escaped and walked on and magnats came down and destroyed them, that would have been still kind of the lovable rogue for me.
Right. It's sort of like if they didn't have that one scene, then it would have been sort of like, aha, you got what you deserve, you know?
And, yeah.
But yeah, with that, it's sort of like, okay.
Maybe this is where Gary Gygax and Arneson basically came up with, your character should be heroes, not assholes.
Well, that is true that he is in no way heroic, that he's definitely out for himself, and only occasionally does he...
He is the villain of the module in some ways.
Sure.
Yes. I mean, this is a module full of villains.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. And most people are trying to screw him over. And I mean, I will say that in general, I find amusing, I guess, the way that everybody subtly is trying to screw everybody over almost all the time.
Sure.
And I kind of enjoyed just the general audacity of Kugel. Like, I mean, just, it's just,
I am this other guy. You know, when he actually gets the eye of the overworld, he just gets his clothes and says, I'm him.
Right. Knocks the guy out, shaves off the guy's beard, sort of like glues it onto his face, you know, wears the other guy's clothes. And like, you don't seem quite like, you know, that other guy that has been serving us for 30 years. Like, I have been transformed by, you know, by the death of the guy that had the, you know, previously had the glasses. And right. So, you know, I'm in shock. And also I'm excited about, you know, getting the glasses. Like, well, that's understandable.
Right. I mean, the eyes of the overworld in the title, which, you know, the title is of this book is really Kugel the Clever. I mean,
that is actually what he wanted the title to be. And they've renamed it that.
I don't know why.
So did they actually define what the overworld was?
As far as I could tell.
They did mention what some person thought it was. So it's a VR world.
That's what I was saying.
Reality world. Yeah, I think it's one of, and the funny thing is, I think it's one of the early examples of kind of virtual reality that I don't find mentioned anywhere else. Like, it's not in the list of like early fictional VR or AR worlds. But yeah, they basically said, oh, you know, there's like 200 something of these cusps that, you know, this demon hundreds of years ago, like, looked into our world from the underworld. And then someone like did something, the demon, like, you know, pulled its tentacles back and the cusp kind of got left behind. So since they can look from the underworld into, you know, our regular world, you can also, when you're in the regular world, you can look into the overworld, which they said was like, I don't remember the phrasing, but it was basically like the land where everyone's hopes and dreams and like the best of everything kind of exists in the idealized form. So it kind of like idealizes, you know, whether it actually exists or whether it's just what people's idealized thought of what things would be exists. So, you know, people's shacks turn into giant, you know, castles and stuff like that.
Right.
But if you manage to get there and then you look up again, then,
well, apparently
things are even more awesome.
Apparently they're full sensory, you know, things too, because right.
Improves the taste of your food.
Yeah.
I mean, they basically kept on bringing them like basic staples and they would eat them and be like, oh, this is amazing. And yeah, the problem was that like Kugel had already seen that all the women would look horribly ugly.
Right. That basically everyone lived in squalor. They lived in these like, you know, open huts and they slept on, you know, rotted reeds or whatever. And just ate basic pulses and like dried fish or something. But when you put the glasses on, suddenly it was like, you know, eating in a fine dining place and you were living in a castle.
They call them restaurants.
Yeah, with hundreds of rooms and stuff like that. And everyone was beautiful. And I did like the thing where he was looking at, you know, that Duri Corwim or whatever her name was. And she was smiling and being all like friendly and stuff. And when he took the glasses off, she looked the same, except she was kind of looking sternly at
him. Which, okay, maybe you can take that as a metaphor. If I didn't really think that I'm reading way too much into this, maybe that's sort of a metaphor for his general dealings with women. It's just like, but except he doesn't ever really think that women are coming on to him. He just sort of doesn't care because he's a monster.
It happened once. You know,
as a monster myself, I take exception to this.
Okay. Anyway, I apologize to Monster Kind. Let's see. I mean, you can generally make a case that he's engaging in massive retaliation, that like there was at one point, like this creature played a harmless trick on him and he basically took something away from it that would cause it to die. I forget exactly.
Oh, yeah. That was like the one where he's, you know, so he meets up these, they're basically like these giant clam creatures or something like that, that he could talk to that are in the water. And he's like asking for a direction somewhere. And he's like, how can I go there? Yeah. And they're like kind of messing with him a bit. And then they tell him kind of where to go. And then they give him this like, you know, magical woven cloak. Cause they say, oh, you look like you'll be cold. So he puts the cloak on and then it turns back into water and drenches him. Mm-hmm. And he basically gets pissed off, runs over and takes a rock and smashes the shell of this creature and grabs it, throws it on the ground. And the thing's like, well, why would you do such a thing? It's like, it was just a jest. And like, you know, you've taken my life from me and I have no other, you know, which was kind of a bizarre wording in the book. But and he basically is still pissed off. He's like, well, now you won't be pulling tricks on anybody else. And, you know, like that kind of, you know, twinged my little, like, you know, like in games and stuff, like, like Wolfenstein 3D, you know, I don't have a problem shooting Nazis in the game. I don't like shooting the dogs though. It's like, oh, don't shoot the doggy. Like,
oh yeah, no, I was having this problem in Zelda. There's a mask you can put on that makes the enemies think that you're one of them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, up till now, I'd had no trouble attacking the enemies because they were always sort of like rawr, attacking right. you. And suddenly they're very friendly. Just like, hi, they're sort of smiling and dancing. And it's just like, I can't hurt these guys.
Take your mask off quick.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, but yeah, I mean, he generally, for any imagined slight, he would respond massively. He did have sort of this relatively clever MO. Well, sometimes it seemed clever where he would just like come in and say, you know, do some kind of con to claim a local status. So he got a hold of like one of the eyes of the overworld and just like, well, now I'm one of the nobles, so no one should accuse me of any crime like stealing one of the eyes of the overworld.
Right.
There's no collusion.
Yeah. And I do love that kind of, you know, goes on into the language of the book because the leader of the nobles slash the people that wore the cusps, you know, he's sort of like, you know, the other guy who was supposed to get the eye is pissed. And he's like, you know, well, he stole it. And he's like, what do you mean? He is now a noble. He's like, he's, you know, the embodiment of goodness and stuff. And he's like, yes, but when he stole it, he wasn't a noble at that time. And he's like, huh, I can't be, you know, I can't deal with, you know, causality, like, you know, and just, you know, a lot of the
now
the
that writing, I'm a noble, I've basically been baptized of all prior sins.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And just the entire book is kind of this Victorian, you know, writing style, which it's a lot of it's written very subtly. And like this book doesn't have a good example of a combat scene, but there's one of the other books where that happens. And it's like, you know, like in a Conan or kind of like pulp adventure book, they would have something where it's like, you know, this graphic descriptions of wrestling and fighting and stuff for like several pages. In this book, it's like, it's one sentence that kind of says, and then he chose to, you know.
And then I ran him through with my sword.
Yeah, but it was sort of like, and then, you know, there was some, you know, whatever happened. It was like one sentence of this, you know, the outcome basically. And they skipped the fighting section in the book.
There was
basically.
An altercation and yeah. I was the victor.
Basically, that's what it said. And like, you know, an altercation occurred or whatever. So I don't know. I like that part of it. I do see what you mean though, that if you weren't into the book, that could make kind of irritating.
I was saying it's like seasoning. It's just like, oh, right. If you like the rest of the dish, it's, oh, how nicely seasoned. The salt really brings out the taste. And you know, if you hate it, it's just like, it's terrible and so much salt.
So how is this not made into a D&D module at some point?
I think it was made into D&D.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what happened. You would have thought that this would have turned into something very explicit, but maybe they just didn't want to deal with licensing or who knows what.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Well, as someone else pointed out too, like even when D&D first came out, this would have not have been considered a recent thing. I mean, it was like in the 50s that the first book was written, so it was sort of like, you know, ancient history for people like, you know, that were playing the stuff and...
So one of the aspects that we wanted to cover was there is some, I believe, critique of organized religion in here.
Well, there did seem to be quite a few. There was a whole section where they had pilgrims and some of them had different beliefs and stuff. And
right. And they were basically being conned. But, you know, even the person conning them, I forget the exact details, but said, oh, you know, because Kugel comes up and he's basically just looking for free protection slash labor to get across this desert. Right,
because there's like these bandits and he's like, we need a big group to like not get attacked.
Right. And so he, you know, he hooks up with this person that gets pilgrims to go out to the desert. So this priest says, oh, well, obviously you coming here was arranged by this god. So it's morally right for me to deceive these pilgrims to go along with you because the god is all powerful. Was
right.
My understanding of what he was saying.
Basically he's like, well, why wouldn't, you know, because he comes up and he says, you know, do you have ways to sort of speak through these, you know, god figurehead statues that you have and, you know, give commands, you know, in the guise of this god? And he's like, well, why wouldn't we? He's like, you know, God is all powerful. So he made you come here, bribe me to basically make the people go do this. And that's his will.
Right.
And he's like totally serious about it. So, you know, there's not just that. There were other, like there was one in one of the other sections where he, you know, he was like espousing his belief about, you know, whatever it was. And Kugel's like, oh, okay. And, you know, he's like, no, it's totally true. He's like, because this part of this thing is self-consistent with other part. And therefore, they both reinforce each other. And like, rather it being some self-referential nonsense, he's like, both parts of this like fiction reinforce the other part. So they're both doubly reinforced.
Yeah, there's sort of like a lot of absurd logic employed by Kugel. And even like the other people to some degree, to a fair degree.
Right. Kugel is a little bit unusually bad in this landscape, a little bit, but not much.
Yeah. He's actually, yeah. He's not more than like, you know, one standard deviation out from everyone else. But right. To the rest of us, we're like, wow, he's really just kind of an asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so I guess I think I got sidetracked before when I was talking about, you know, his audacity of stuff where
sure.
At the very beginning when he gets caught by Yukinu and Yukinu's like, hey, you know, I can put you in the Forlorn Encystment, you know, 45 miles into the ground where you basically are alive forever, you know, trapped underground, or you can go get these things for me. And he's like, and Kugel's like, well, you know, it would be great if I could like, you know, sleep and, you know, have some nice rest here and you can give me some nice food so I can, you know, before I go. And he's like, are you kidding me? He's like, do you realize how lucky you are that you're not, you know, currently insisted or whatever? And he's like, oh no, no, I just, you know, want to make sure everything succeeds, you know? And, or like, you know, there was that one where they're making that giant like thing to pull totality to it.
Right.
The big stonework thing. And the magician's like, hey, you know, you need to come up so I can do a divination. And he's like, well, I want to meditate on this for a few days, you know, to see if it's the right course. So your nympharium over there seems like the right place that I could meditate for a few days. And it's just like, you know, it's just like the audacity.
Could you force some women to have sex with
yeah,
me?
Yeah, basically. And it's just like, oh, okay.
Yes. And I don't remember exactly how, but he also wound up with, what was it? A device of erotic pleasure or something like
that. Yes, yeah. That was one of the pills. Actually, that took me quite a long time before I think I got what they were talking about, where they were talking about the lustral rites that the pilgrims are going to. And later on, I think based on what someone said in passing, that I think the lustral rites were like lust, right? It wasn't like, because at first I thought it was like, you know, just the name for some rites. And then I realized, oh, they're like,
basically, they're going to do an orgy in the desert.
Yeah, I think that's what it was, because
Vance kind of likes orgies in the desert. Didn't that, wasn't the hidden rites of the women basically a big orgy in the desert?
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right.
So it's like pre Burning Man.
Well, he basically, he invented Burning Man.
He invented Burning
Man. He was writing short stories for pulp magazines. So I guess it would make sense that that would be a common subject. But yeah, well, anyway.
By no means.
By no means, yes. One of his catchphrases. And it seems to be one of Vance's catchphrases too.
That meant no.
Yes, but it was, you know, it was kind of another example of the Victorian phrasing of like, you know, everyone said it, but he said it a lot. Yeah. You know, would you like this? Oh, by no means.
the writing was a bit flowery for my taste.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I guess it's not that long of a book, but I was getting a little tired of it near the end.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Lovecraft. It wasn't quite as bad as, you know, you sort of, with Lovecraft, you finally, you know, piece it apart and then it's just like, ew, when you sort of figure out what exactly he was actually right. Describing. And this one near is sort of like, figure out what he was actually describing, and it's just like, oh yeah, he's an asshole.
Surprise.
Yeah
So was there tea?
No, I don't think so.
I'm surprised I didn't like this book more then.
There's a lot of watered down wine and stuff in it, but
yes,
I think that's
now, that's cruel.
That's the only liquid I could remember being in the book is some water and then wine.
Yes,
there's that very kind of bizarre, disturbing scene that happened in the Pilgrims. You know, the one we talked about where they all got sent by, essentially by Kugel bribing the guy out through the desert to guard him. And so, you know, 80% of them got killed, you know, going through the desert. And at the end, you know, everyone's kind of like, we're in the middle of nowhere. We're going to die. We don't have enough stuff to get back. What are we going to do? And of course, the true guys, the truly faithful are like, let's keep on going. You know, we're almost right there. And then like the basically the dissenters are like, screw this. We're just going to like figure out something else to do. So their solution is they found this group of this village of lizard people. They killed all the men. filed the teeth of the women lizard people and dressed them up in like rags, basically, and then installed themselves as the new lords of the lizard people village. And I'm just thinking that's disturbing on so many levels. And I was kind of, I'm like, no, is this just a weird thing? Is this like some colonialism commentary or like what, you know?
I think I'm going to add Lord of the Lizard People as to the band name list. We are the lords of the lizard people.
And, you know, that wasn't even something that Kugel suggested. That was just like, you know, one of the, these were the pilgrims, you know, for this, you know, religious sect, right?
Well, I'm sure that they were doing their lustral rites right there.
Right. So, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying is like, is this some kind of like colonialism or something, you know, related to, you know, Christian kind of stuff, or is just some crazy thing that like,
I think you're reading too much into the book.
Probably.
Just like, oh, this would be cool. This is like if a six-year-old could write, you know, adult with a six-year-old mentality in some ways.
But I think
mean to insult Vance.
I mean, what is the comic book Axe Cop was actually helped written by a six-year-old, and that was actually awesome.
Exactly. Yes. That's where I'm going with this. This is basically Axe Cop.
What is he? He's a cop with an axe or an arm.
Yep, that was pretty awesome.
There was a cop, and then he found the perfect axe, and he became Axe Cop.
So, did anybody have favorite characters or something they'd like to be?
Oh, Kugel. No.
I don't know who I'd want to be in this book. I mean, I'm fairly sure you guys think that I should be Kugel.
See, honestly, I thought that you would find Kugel amusing. That's part of the reason I picked the book.
I don't. I hated him with a passion. Like, I didn't have a lot to say about
him. Doesn't like competition.
He could be Furks, like, you know, always like irritating people and putting them in the right direction.
Yeah, I guess that's an option, but I don't know.
I don't know. I guess Yukinu or something like that. I'd be one of the magicians, but I don't know which one because they're all really bizarre.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have anybody for this one.
Well, I guess that kind of is, you know, along the lines of my... It's kind of hard to pick, you know, from here, but, you know, probably one of my favorite scenes was sort of the last scene of the book where... You know, he goes back to, you know, he has this basic...
It's a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Yeah, yeah. He goes back...
Does he make a left at Albuquerque?
To, you know, return the cusp. And so he has a fake one made and he has this, you know, grand plan that he kept saying, what's the flaw? There is none. You know, where if you look through one eye of the cusp and the other eye through not the overworld...
I mean, was an actual clever plan, right. Which worked. And it startled me quite a bit.
Well, it worked because, it didn't work as he expected, right?
Right. Well, it worked on the glass blower that made the thing.
Oh, right. It worked on everybody that he tried it on, basically.
And then,
medical, you know, magical experimentation.
So don't, you know, if you have VR glasses, look through both eyes at the same time, not through one, it'll mess you up.
Right.
So basically, he goes back. And immediately the reader can tell, Yukinu is no longer Yukinu. Yukinu has been taken over by Furks's, you know, whoever that is, buddy from the vats.
It took me a while actually to figure out what had happened to him, but it was very clear to me. Yeah, that's not Yukinu.
Right. And he can't remember who he is. And he's like, oh, yes. And then
it all becomes clear to me. Actually, I do have to give the narrator some credit there.
Yeah, he did a good job with not Furks, but, you know, Furks's co-planet owner or whatever, like that, you know, he did have to make weird zip zap noises and exactly. stuff, and it wasn't
is not correct.
Yeah, right. And so this is a great example of Kugel basically causing his own trouble, because he basically lucks into winning the lottery by, he's like, look, I could own this, you know, giant magical castle with all of its magic items and like mountains of gold, but he has to take revenge on Yukinu.
Right.
And he wants not just to kill him, he wants to make sure that Yukinu knows that he's getting revenge on him. So he like goes through all this stuff to like rip the creature that's controlling Yukinu out of him, and he binds him up and he's taking him down to the fair and like putting him up for display and all this stuff. And basically he's like, okay, let's find some more stuff.
Or, you know, even before then, you know, he gets Furks, this thing that's like forcing him along this journey, extracted from his stomach.
Right. And he could have just, and even the other magician said that, well, Yukinu is, you know,
really vain.
Yeah. And so if you just left and ignored him, that would piss him off more than anything.
And now he's gone and gotten this precious artifact, and now he can just have it free and clear.
Right.
So he's won. And now he's just like, nope, I've got to find a way to destroy myself.
Right. So he goes back and does all that stuff. he has Yukinu in his power. The other guy who, oh, this is another thing where that, you know, the Fianister, the guy who also had a booth that suggests in the first place that he goes and breaks in and steals from Yukinu to start this whole thing. And Fianister says, by any true rights, I own half this property basically because I'm the one who suggested you steal from him. And you're like, really?
No.
So the median for true rights in this world is definitely a bit askew. So, but of course he's like, I'm just not just going to burn you alive or something. I'm going to do what you did to me. So he tries to do these like really high level magic spells, which he can't. And he kind of knows that he's not that great, but he kind of risks it. He's like, okay, I'll do the forlorn insistment on the Fianister guy.
Then he does that backwards.
He does it backwards. All the guys that have been insisted over the ages pop out.
It's like a poor spell failure roll.
Yeah, just reverses it.
They rolled a one.
And so, you know, that was kind of awesome anyway. Like they all pop out and, you know, all their stuff's, the clothes are rotted away. And he's like, crap, okay, well, I know that I failed on that one, but this time I'll for sure not do it.
And, you know, I'm going to send you to where you sent me.
Right. So he casts the spell.
Yeah.
Again, messes it up, and the demon comes, drops him right next to the
first cage.
The first cage. And it's just like, okay, you could have had all that stuff, but no, you had to have your revenge and cause your own trouble, basically.
Yes. He's an incompetent asshole. All right. Well, time for us to get moving, I think. So
wait.
Actually, sorry, dude. World's coming to an end.
I will just say one thing. If you want to experience this world without Kugel, I suggest that you just jump to the fourth book in the series, Rialto the Marvelous, which is sort of like a friendly guy who's kind of bumbly as opposed to a complete psychotic guy. So you can kind of experience this world, you know, in a cheerier way by just reading the fourth book and skip the Kugel ones if you don't want to deal with that.
It's not WWCD, it's WWRD and Chef Boyardee.
Absolutely. All right. Well, looks to me like the sun is going out and the earth is dying.
Yay.
This is so clever. Like us, we are the podcast, The Clever.
Exactly.
Send us food and money.
For punishment.
Yes, I will feel very punished.
All right. Well, we will probably return unless the universe actually fails. And we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.